Hello, this is Mary Ellen, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the September 30th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. On the front page of today's paper, Israeli leader backs Trump on truce plan. This article is by Aaron Boxerman, Liam Stack, Adam Razgran, and Michael Levinson. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel said on Monday that he supported a 20-point plan released by President Trump to end the Israeli military campaign in Gaza, free the remaining hostages, and rebuild the devastated territory. But Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu, speaking at the White House, both said they would support Israel continuing the war if Hamas rejected the deal. Hamas had no immediate comment on the proposal, and it appeared improbable at best that Hamas would agree to a demand in the plan that is to disarm without a full Israeli withdrawal from the territory. Mr. Netanyahu said that if Hamas did not embrace the proposal, then Israel will finish the job by itself. He added, "This can be done the easy way or it can be done the hard way, but it will be done." Mr. Trump said that if Hamas did not agree to the proposal, he would support Israel as it continues its military assault, which has killed tens of thousands of Palestinians. "Israel would have my full backing to finish the job of destroying the threat of Hamas," Mr. Trump said. Before Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu spoke, Taher al-Nunun, a senior Hamas official, said in a televised interview on Monday that the group had not been involved in developing the plan. "When it comes to this plan, no one contacted us, nor were we part of the negotiations around it," he said. Still, Mr. Trump expressed hope that the proposal would finally bring an end to the nearly two-year war and create a framework to govern post-war Gaza. "It calls for Gaza to be governed by a temporary, technocratic, apolitical Palestinian committee overseen by an international board of peace, which would be led by Mr. Trump and include other world leaders, including Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister. Hamas would have no role in governing Gaza under the plan," which the White House released on Monday, just before Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu spoke to reporters. "We're at a minimum very, very close," Mr. Trump said, "and I think we're beyond very close." Mr. Netanyahu thanked him for offering the proposal. "I support your plan to end the war in Gaza, which achieves our war aims," he said. "It will bring back to Israel all our hostages, dismantle Hamas's military capability, end its political rule, and ensure that Gaza never again poses a threat to Israel." The proposal calls for Israel to pull back its forces to an unspecified agreed-upon line within Gaza to prepare for the return of the remaining hostages who were seized during the Hamas-led attack on Israel on October the 7th, 2023. At least 20 of them are still believed to be alive in Gaza, according to Israel. "The bodies of about 25 are also being held in the territory," Israel says. "All would have to be released within 72 hours of Israel accepting the plan." Israel would then withdraw further once an international stabilization force was ready to step in, and it would not occupy or annex Gaza, the plan states. But Mr. Netanyahu said Israel would be allowed to maintain a sizable buffer zone inside Gaza's borders for the foreseeable future. Once the hostages were released, Israel would release 250 prisoners serving life sentences, as well as 1,700 Gazans who were detained after October the 7th, 2023, including all the women and children being held. Hamas members who commit to peaceful coexistence and turn over their weapons would be granted amnesty, the plan says. Those who chose to leave Gaza would be given safe passage to other countries. Hamas would have to forsake any role in governing Gaza, have its arms and military infrastructure destroyed, and agree to a supervised demilitarization. The proposals focus on demilitarize in Gaza presents a challenge for Hamas, which has publicly refused demands that it disarm, describing its weapons as legitimate tools to fight Israel. The Prime Minister of Qatar, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, and the Chief of Egypt's General Intelligence Services, General Hassan Rashad, met with Hamas negotiators and shared Mr. Trump's plan, according to two regional officials briefed on the meeting, who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive details. Hamas, the regional officials said, pledged to review the proposal in good faith and offer a response. The proposal alludes to a role for the Palestinian Authority, which partly administers the Israeli-occupied West Bank, after it completes a reform program. Once that happens, the plan says, the conditions may finally be in place for a credible pathway to Palestinian self-determination and statehood. The vague language around Palestinian statehood came after a week in which Britain, France, and other European countries announced that they would recognize a Palestinian state over Israeli objections. The ceasefire plan was also released as Israeli forces continued to sweep through Gaza City, forcing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to flee. Many have been displaced multiple times over the past 2 years in a seemingly endless nightmare of fear, hunger, and bombardment. Talks around a ceasefire have been at a standstill since Israel bombed Qatar on September the 9th in a failed attempt to assassinate Hamas top leadership in the Persian Gulf nation, a brazen attack that drew international condemnation. Just before he spoke with Mr. Trump on Monday, Mr. Netanyahu sought to defuse tensions unleashed by the strike. On a phone call hosted by the American president, Mr. Netanyahu told Qatar's Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed that Israel regretted that a Qatari citizen had been killed in the attack, according to Mr. Netanyahu's office. He also said that Israel had no plans to violate Qatar's sovereignty again. Sheikh Mohammed had described the strike as state terror and called for his Israeli counterpart to be brought to justice. Qatar, a U.S. ally that has been a key mediator in ceasefire talks, said in a statement after Mr. Netanyahu's call that it was ready to continue working to bring an end to the war in Gaza. But three far-right ministers in Mr. Netanyahu's government were quick to denounce Mr. Netanyahu's conciliatory call to the Qatari Prime Minister. The submissive apology to a state that supports and funds terror is a disgrace, Bezalel Smotrich, the Israeli finance minister, wrote on social media. The Israeli National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, said the Israeli attack on Qatar was important, right, and moral like no other. Israeli critics say Mr. Netanyahu has in the past rebuffed workable ceasefire plans with Hamas to pursue what the prime minister calls absolute victory over the group. Israel's campaign has killed more than 65,000 people in Gaza, according to local health officials, without decisively muting Hamas. Mr. Blair, who has supported the establishment of transitional authority to govern and reconstruct Gaza, said in a statement that Mr. Trump had released a bold and intelligent plan. He added that it offered the best chance of ending 2 years of war, misery, and suffering. Swaggering and Scandalous, a Singular New York Mayor. This article is by Matt Flegenheimer. Eric Adams promised New Yorkers he would be unlike any mayor his city had ever seen. Or on that, and often so little less, his word was never in doubt. It can be said that no other mayor had his eyebrows threaded in public, claimed to take bubble baths with roses, mused openly about carrying a handgun in church, that no other mayor was equally likely to spend his evenings out with his old police friends, known felons, bemused celebrities, homeless subway riders, that no other mayor left so much uncertainty about where he slept, what he ate, whether he really just said what he said, whose side he was on. He was for law and order and reform and inertia and immigrants and crackdowns and swagger and nightlight and mornings and protesters and counter-protesters and possessive adjectives, my workers, my teachers, my bond rating, and officially city attire that said mayor on as many surfaces as possible. He was for the old ways, the clubhouse, the unions, the people who knew people, and the new ways with their viral influencers and crypto bros and big ideas, guys who always seem to have a contact in Florida. He had two maxims that resonate most in hindsight. I'm perfectly imperfect, Mr. Adams said often. True enough, I am you, he often told voters. That one was more complicated. In many ways, Mr. Adams' choice to end his flailing re-election campaign was the most conventional thing he had done in some time. He was acceding, for once, to the laws of political gravity as he weighed how best to position himself for a post-mayoral future. That set of options, like most of his last year, is already shadowed by the more brazen gambit he has long appeared to embrace amid federal corruption charges and the wholesale collapsing of his inner circle, becoming a mega amenable mayor of America's signature big blue city and seeing where this might take him. In the video on Sunday announcing the end of his run, Mr. Adams inveighed, as ever, against the news media and perceived political enemies whom he accused of dooming his re-election beyond salvation. He noted the very real external challenges he faced, particularly the COVID aftermath and the migrant crisis, and saluted his own leadership. He endorsed neither Zohran Mamdani, the left-wing Democratic nominee, nor Andrew Cuomo, the now independent challenger whom Mr. Adams has come to despise. For weeks as his campaign wheezed, Mr. Adams had made little secret of his disdain for his political adversaries, suggesting that those opposing him were out for themselves and not New Yorkers. Yet Mr. Adams, whose election 4 years ago invited speculation, often from Mr. Adams himself, that he represented the future of the National Democratic Party, was undone when too many voters had too many suspicions that Eric Adams was out for himself and not them. For months, as President Trump and those around him dangled the dismissal of Mr. Adams' federal case like a golden ticket, the mayor declined to criticize the president, gushed about helping the White House deport criminal migrants, and conspicuously nice things about Elon Musk before Mr. Musk falling out with the president, and canceled various plans in the city to attend sessions with Mr. Trump or his acolytes. In his indictment last year, which said Mr. Adams had accepted free and heavily discounted travel arrangements from the Turkish government, the mayor stood criminally accused of leveraging his office to help himself. In trying to escape that indictment, he appeared to be leveraging his office to help himself. In an Inauguration Day sequence that, to Mr. Adams, many critics best encapsulated his willingness to sell out his city if necessary, the mayor was driven to Washington around 3 a.m. after scoring a last-minute invitation to Mr. Trump swearing in. Inside the Capitol, he subsisted in an overflow room with fellow borderline VIP elected officials, congressional spouses, and pro-Trump YouTubers. New Yorkers can take a lot. Obsequiousness is a tough look. Resign, a few subway riders shouted at Mr. Adams in January during an unannounced ride through the system. Some cursed him out. Mr. Adams' smile never broke. 8.3 million people, Adams said, of one profane passerby, 35 million opinions. The shame of his majority, even allies have long said, is that it did not need to be this way. His visceral In the Room appeal, Bootstraps biography, and ideological non-fussiness. He alternately called himself a pragmatic moderate and the original progressive, had earned him his dream job for a reason. As he liked to say without ever totally closing the loop on the metaphor, he had turned his haters into his waiters. "Why do I keep winning?" Mr. Adams asked, extremely rhetorically, in an interview shortly before his election. He kept winning because he was a winner. Still, even back then, some close to him knew and repeatedly told Mr. Adams that others close to him might get him into trouble. When the investigative raids and indictments mounted last year, leveling City Hall, there was almost a grim resignation among some longtime supporters. Political prognosticators can be wrong about a lot, including Mr. Adams, as he still likes to remind anyone who doubts him. But they were not wrong broadly in assessing that if an Adams administration failed, its end would look at least something like this. Warnings abounded. 4 years ago, the Reverend Al Sharpton, who has known the mayor of for decades, came to Mr. Adams with a gentle reminder. The then candidate was facing minor criticism for dining at Rao's, the famed Scorsese-worthy East Harlem red sauce spot, with John Katzimatidis, a billionaire friend of Mr. Trump's, and Bo Dietl, a gadfly former police detective. Mr. Adams was about to be mayor. Mr. Sharpton told him that things would be different. Appearances mattered. He says, "Well, I hear you," Mr. Sharpton recalled then laughing, "but you know me. I'm going to do me." He kept that promise, too. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service from the September 30th issue. Inside the Times. Inside a Queen's Home with a Colorful Past by T.M. Brown. T.M. Brown is a freelance journalist and regular contributor to the Times. An acid trip in house form. That was how my editor on the real estate desk, Matthew Oshinsky, described the ridiculous house in Astoria, Queens that he was proposing I cover a few months ago. The exterior of the house, I found out, was painted a painfully mismatched butter yellow and fire engine red. A surrounding wrought iron gate was emblazoned with metal flowers in the same mustard and ketchup color scheme. The interior was just as outlandish, sofas and chandeliers in all the colors of the rainbow, and a fake cherry blossom tree sprouting from the living room floor. I began my reporting by searching for the property owner's name. Eventually, I found a name, Jasmine Beccari, and it appeared she owned other properties across the borough. So I typed three words into Google, Jasmine Beccari, Queens. The first result shocked me. It was a 2023 news release from the U.S. Attorney's Office, Eastern District of New York, saying that someone named Rashidum Bokhari from Astoria had been convicted of embezzling more than $1 million from three people, also Bengali Americans, in a real estate scam. Mr. Beccari was ordered to serve 38 months in a federal prison facility and pay restitution of nearly $1.5 million to his victims. He is also Jasmine Beccari's husband. I searched for both of their names and discovered a civil suit that predated the criminal trial by a year. In this suit, the plaintiff alleged that Ms. Beccari had knowledge of her husband's misdeeds and that she had used an LLC she owned to obscure how the embezzled funds were being used. The civil case had been halted in 2022 while the criminal court process had played out. I thought it was suspicious that a woman named in a pending lawsuit was trying to sell a property for $3 million while her husband claimed he couldn't afford to pay back the people he had admitted to stealing from. I wanted to find out whether Mr. Beccari's victims were at risk of never being paid back And if Ms. Bokhari was trying to sell these properties before the government could seize them. Several properties owned by Ms. Bokhari have been passed back and forth among her husband and her and other family members over the past two decades. Nearly every deed transfer was done for no consideration, a real estate term for homes changing hands for free. I called a forensic accountant who told me that people sometimes use this maneuver to hide assets and avoid scrutiny from law enforcement. I called Neil Fellenbaum, the lawyer representing Aslam Ansari, the plaintiff in the civil suit, who said that the Bokharis had defrauded more than a dozen other people in the Bangladeshi community in Queens. These people were reluctant to come forward because they were frightened by U.S. immigration and customs enforcement actions across the country. Convincing those unidentified accusers to be interviewed for my article was a delicate process. There was a fear of the government, sure, but many were also embarrassed and ashamed that they could be fooled by somebody from their own tight-knit community. I assured them I would protect their identities, and I told them that this would be a way to tell their story safely. When they finally agreed to being interviewed, we set up a meeting in Mr. Fellenbach's office. I arrived early, and the photographer Thea Traff, who would later shoot silhouetted portraits of each person. I wasn't sure how many accusers would actually show up. I was anxious that it would only be one or two, but as we sat in the glass-walled conference room, a group of nine men and women walked into the office vestibule together. "I am ashamed. I am a fool," one man told me, his voice shaking. I sat across from him as he told me how he'd been deceived by someone he had known for decades. I asked the group why they had decided to talk to me after suffering in silence for so long. A few said they'd been scammed by the Bokharis in the past few years, while others had money stolen a decade ago. "It's a good question," one man said. He paused for a moment. "I don't have any hope left. I need my money back. I just want to be able to give something to my daughter." I worked on this article, which was published online on September 16th, for 3 months. In that time, I never had the opportunity to speak with the Bokharis or their lawyers, who refused to return my many calls. But I could sense that they knew something was happening. The price on the flamboyant home that Ms. Bokhari was selling was reduced by $500,000, from $3 million to $2.5 million. Then the government slapped a lien on both that house and another property in Jamaica, Queens, owned by Ms. Bokhari, for the amount that Mr. Bokhari had been ordered to repay his victims. After the article was published, Mr. Fellenbaum called me. He told me the story had apparently caused a national sensation, albeit not in the United States. It was all over the TV news in Bangladesh, he said. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Facts of interest. Women tend to have worse sleep than men, especially during perimenopause, whether because of night sweats or a diagnosable sleep disorder. That's a quote from Do Women Need Separate Longevity Guidelines? Across England's southern coast, fishing crews reported an extraordinary boom in octopus catches this summer. Scientists say warming water temperatures make the region more hospitable to a particular species of octopus. This is from Octopuses Bring Windfalls and Anxieties to England's Southern Coast. A recent survey of customers by Gusto, which provides payroll and related services to small businesses, found that 50% of companies thought tariffs had hurt their business this year, and 56% expected them to do so next year. It's a quote from Small Businesses Wilt Under Tariffs, It's Hard to Breathe. The 1985 single, We Are the World, written by Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson, and recorded with a bevy of luminaries, sold 800,000 copies in 3 days and raised $80 million for famine relief in Africa. That's a quote from Lionel Richie, opens up in a memoir. Captive reptile welfare is notoriously poor. Many reptiles are kept in inappropriate conditions, such as close confinement and without enrichment. Is it in the mood to come out of its shell? More than 145 people around the country have lost their jobs for posting negatively about Charlie Kirk on social media. It's from an article commenting on Kirk privately on Facebook. He had a high price. 3 million people fly in and out of U.S. airports every day. It's from a new theory on in-flight turbulence. Reader Corner, call out, do you use AI chatbots for health advice? As a reporter covering the intersection between artificial intelligence and healthcare, Teddy Rosenbluth often writes about how doctors and health systems use the technology. Roughly 1 in 6 adults and 1/4 of adults under 30 regularly use artificial intelligence chatbots to find health information or get advice. Ms. Rosenbluth wants to understand how you are using chatbots to manage your personal health. Tell us, what chatbot do you use and what are the kinds of questions you ask it? Are those different from questions you might Google? Has a chatbot provided medical advice that you found helpful or conversely led you astray? To share your experience with AI chatbots, fill out a form at newyorktimes.com/readers. No part of your submission will be published until after we've contacted you and heard back. Listen in. Excerpts from the New York Times audio. Casey Newton and Jeremy Newfield discuss President Trump's new H-1B visa fee. President Trump signed a proclamation this month adding a $100,000 fee for the H-1B visas that allow foreign workers like software engineers a chance to be employed in the United States. Jeremy Newfield, an immigration expert and the director of immigration policy at Institute for Progress, joined Hard Fork to help make sense of the Trump administration's changes. Read an edited excerpt from his exchange with the host, Casey Newton. What is the H-1B system? What was it originally designed to do? The H-1B visa is our flagship high-skilled immigration visa. It's intended for people in specialty occupations, and there's 85,000 of these in H-1Bs that are available each year for the private sector. Universities and national laboratories get access to as many H-1Bs as they want without being subject to that cap. But I think one way to think about the H-1B system is that it's really a couple of different talent pipelines under the same umbrella. So on the one hand, it's an incredibly valuable source for top talent, for international scientists, and for top founders of tech companies like Elon Musk. And then at the same time, it's the same visa that's being used for lower skilled talent like IT consultancy services. I think one of the things that happens with the debut around this visa is the defenders of the program are pointing to very true things. They're pointing to the amazing contributions that H-1B holders have made for the United States for our scientific and technological leadership. The critics are also pointing to real cases of certain companies like Infosys and Cognizant taking a huge number of these visas and bringing in relatively low-skilled workers who might be undercutting Americans. Both of these sides have a point because the program is not one thing, it's a lot of different kinds of things. This is from the opinion page of the New York Times. Go ahead, blame moms. The article is by Jessica Gross, a writer in opinion and the author of a Times newsletter on the way we live now. Less than 6 months ago, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Secretary of Health and Human Services, said, "By September, we'll know what has caused the autism epidemic and we'll be able to eliminate those exposures." When I heard this, I assumed that the Trump administration would offer a convenient scapegoat for the complicated diagnosis because we already know there are no quick answers to be found. Scientists have been studying the condition for decades, and a single root cause has eluded them. The autism triggers put forward by Mr. Kennedy in the past, most notably vaccines, have been thoroughly studied and ruled out. I was surprised that President Trump and the rest of the federal health establishment zeroed in on the association between pregnant women taking Tylenol, a brand name for the drug acetaminophen, and their children developing autism. I thought they were going to blame antidepressants or the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. To be clear, the strongest studies on the correlation between Tylenol and autism, which compare siblings, suggest that if there were a link, it is not causative. In a rambling yet impassioned diatribe last Monday, Mr. Trump said, "Taking Tylenol is not good. All right, I'll say it. It's not good. For this reason, they are strongly recommending that women limit Tylenol use during pregnancy unless medically necessary. That's, for instance, in case of extremely high fever that you feel you can't tough it out." He kept repeating, "Pregnant women who are suffering should tough it out," as if they weren't already. Mr. Trump expressed similar sentiments in a Truth Social post on Friday. "Pregnant women don't use Tylenol unless absolutely necessary," all in caps, his. This implies that pregnant women are just selfishly and ignorantly popping pills in the first place. The truth is closer to the fact that most pregnant women around the world are afraid of taking medication because they fear birth defects and they tend to overestimate the risk of common medications and underplay the benefits. Here, Mr. Trump is picking up on a historical thread that was popular when he was a child. The idea that thoughtless mothers are somehow to blame for their children's autism, which has been around nearly as long as the disorder has had a name. Leo Kanner, the doctor whose research led to establishing the first diagnostic criteria for autism in 1943, spoke in his initial paper on the disorder that we must assume these children have come into the world with innate inability to form the usual biologically provided affective contact with people, just as other children come into the world with innate physical or intellectual handicaps. But according to the science writer Edward Dolnick in Madness on the Couch, Blaming the Victim, in the heyday of psychoanalysis, by the end of the 40s, Dr. Kanner had, based on a sample of just 50 additional patients, changed his mind and concluded that the root cause of autism was bad mothering. Maternal lack of general warmth is often conspicuous in the first visit to the clinic. As they come up the stairs, the child trails forlornly behind the mother who does not bother to look back. The refrigerator mother explanation caught on quickly, picked up by other therapists like Bruno Bettelheim, and in the popular press because of concurrent trends in science and motherhood in post-war America. With the introduction of antibiotics, sanitation, and more widely available vaccines in the first half of the century, child and maternal mortality plummeted. These public health victories could have created a society where we put less pressure on individuals, but because of 1950s expectations of ideal motherhood, that ever-smiling queen of the spotless kitchen, they provided fuel for the mother-blaming of the post-war era, according to Rima D. Apple in her book, Perfect Motherhood, Science and Child-Rearing in America. Ms. Apple continued, "Social critics denounced women who stepped out of their traditional role for creating many of the problems of the day, such as juvenile delinquency, the decline of the American home, and even child mortality and morbidity. Though Dr. Kanner would later walk back the idea that cold mothering was responsible for autism, the damage had been done. What could be simpler? Mr. Dolnick asked. Children who have been driven to autism by their inadequate or neglectful parents could still be claimed, and the medicine was no more exotic than a mother's hug. A similar simplistic and even dangerous logic follow here is just don't take Tylenol. Beyond refraining from Tylenol use, Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Trump last week offered another simple solution for autism. They were hyping the drug leucovorin and are pushing it through the FDA's review process, though it does not appear to be a universal silver bullet. According to Matthew Herper of STAT, several small studies have shown that leucovorin, folinic acid, can improve verbal ability of people with autism, but that the effects are not enormous, and small studies are more prone to false positives that may disappear in larger studies. Even Dr. Richard Fry, who suggested the idea of leucovorin in federal officials, told the Associated Press, "We were kind of surprised that they were just approving it right out of the gate without more studies or anything." As is often the case, in the middle of his rambles, Mr. Trump says something that is unintentionally revealing. While he was blathering on about pumping babies full of too much liquid from 80 vaccines, not true in any way, he said, "When you go from all of those, you know, healthy babies to a point where I don't even structurally know if a country can afford it." The problem is not, as the president suggested, then we have too many children who have special needs. There will always be people with chronic illnesses and disorders, no matter how much medical progress is made. It's that we have still not built a society that is structurally equipped to accommodate them in a humane way. And the current administration's stingy approach to healthcare is only making the problem worse. It's far easier to focus on individual mothers and the unproven promise of miracle drugs than to create a system that supports us all. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, and this is the September 30th issue. From the international page of the New York Times. This article is by Stephen Castle. Octopuses bring windfalls and anxieties to England's southern coast. Brixham, England. Expecting his normal catch of plaice, turbo, and Dover sole, Arthur Dewhurst was surprised when his net spilled their contents onto his ship's deck earlier this year. Instead of shiny flipping fish, hundreds of octopuses wriggled and writhed. His first thought, dollar signs, dollar signs, dollar signs, he recalled with a laugh, sitting in his trawler last month in the harbor of Brixham in Devon, England. Across England's southern coast, fishing crews reported an extraordinary boom in octopus catches this summer. Sold for about around 7 pounds a kilo, it was sometimes worth an extra 10,000 pounds, which is $13,475 a week, to Mr. Dewhurst, he said. In Brixham, home to England's largest fish market, the octopus invasion is the talk of the town. A quayside cafe decorated its frontage with an octopus-themed mural. A restaurant offered octopus alongside its staple fish and chips, and its owner demonstrated in a social media video how to cook a species still relatively unusual in British kitchens. There are several theories about the cause of this phenomenon, but scientists say that warming water temperatures make the region more hospitable to this species of octopus, which is normally found off the Mediterranean coast. According to Steve Simpson, a professor of marine biology at the University of Bristol, climate change is a likely driver of the population boom. We're right on the north limit of the octopus species range, but our waters are getting warmer, so our little island of Great Britain is becoming increasingly favorable for octopus populations, he said. There is jubilation among many trawler crews in this scenic fishing port, but among those who fish for crab and lobster, there is anxiety. They initially hauled up tons of lucrative octopus, which had colonized their crab and lobster pots, but now they are increasingly finding empty shells and other skeletal remains, evidence that the eight-armed arrivals are devouring shellfish. Just about everyone agrees that the situation is unique in recent times. It's the first time I've caught them in 49 years, said Dave Driver, 64, whose trawler has made some modest octopus catches, even though he does not fish in the deep waters the species prefer. At the fish market, Barry Young, managing director of Brixham Trawler Agents, which operates the auction, in that between January and August, 12,000 tons of octopus was sold, including 48 tons on one day alone. "We just got invaded," Mr. Young said, "day on, day of more and more. It was phenomenal that we were seeing these amounts, and it was a windfall." The sting in the tail, however, is that Mediterranean octopuses, as well as being highly intelligent, are voracious predators. The plural is not octopi, but octopuses, or even octopodes, according to most dictionaries, as the word comes from the Greek, not Latin. "They were using the crab pots as a dining room, as a restaurant," Mr. Young said. "The octopus were eating crabs and lobsters. They're ferocious animals. You can just imagine the devastation they were causing as they were going through, eating everything in their path." Mr. Young thinks that octopuses last arrived en masse in nearby waters in the early 1950s, only to vanish again within a year or two. So what happens next year is impossible to predict. They could turn up or they could not. "We didn't know they were turning up this year," he said, adding with a laugh, "They didn't ring us and say, we're on our way." Lately, catches have been tailing off as summer has turned to fall, and on one recent morning, just two boxes remained in the fish market at 8 a.m., containing one creature weighing in at 5.4 kilo, the other at 6.8 kilo, or about 12 and 15 pounds. The rest of the day's 1,200 kilos of octopus had sold by 6 a.m., destined probably for Spain and Portugal, where it fetches a higher price than in Britain. Capitalizing on the surge, Robert Andre Simonetti, owner of Brixham Simply Fish restaurant, explained on social media how he salts octopus overnight, then simmers it for up to 2 hours in boiling water with onion and a bay leaf, letting it cool slowly before char grilling or roasting it the next day. Preparing it can be, he admitted, it'd be a messy old job, you get ink everywhere, but its flavor, almost like a strong lobster, makes it worth the effort. "The whole town was talking about it because it's a rarity to catch so much. We served it char-grilled with hummus sauce. It went really well," he said. With its port and fish market, Brixham is the octopus capital of England, without a doubt, added Mr. Simonetti as he worked in his restaurant. Even before the recent surge in catches, a neon image of the eight-limbed creature adorned a key side building in Brixham Harbor. Then in May, a mural was added to the front of Tides, a cafe. The owner, Claire Brinicombe, chose a design that reflected what local fishermen had told her about their abundant catches. She said, adding, "It's the year of the octopus." There's less euphoria further down the Devonshire coast in Salcombe, where those who rely on catching shellfish are now counting the potential cost to the octopus boom. Crab and lobster are the main catch for John Durham. But in February, he went out to sea one morning and hauled his pots, only to be greeted by hundreds of aliens. "It was a bit of a shock. We had never had to deal with them before," he said. "They're incredibly strong when they hold on to a pot. It's all you can do to get them out." He added, "We were putting them in bins on the stern and they were crawling out. They were so active, we didn't know what we were doing. The crew learned fast how to deal with the new arrivals, and on one trip, Mr. Dorham caught almost 3 tons a nice day, bringing in 20,000 pounds, or almost $27,000. But boom turned to bust as Mr. Dorham, 64, hauled in his lobster pots only to discover them empty, aside from shell and skeletal remains, with the flesh sucked out of the claws. The shape of his business in the future will depend on whether octopuses return next year and what damage they've wreaked on the crab and lobster population on which he depends. If the boat doesn't catch, you don't get a wage, Mr. Doran said, standing at the wheel of his 15-meter vessel as it chugged through Salcombe Harbor, reflecting on how his fate is now linked to that of the capricious cephalopods. I personally am terrified. New digital way to pay in Brazil has become a target of the U.S. The PIX payment system is largely popular in Brazil, where the finance minister, Fernando Haddad, said it was replacing cash. A popcorn stand at Ipanema Beach in Rio de Janeiro displays a PIX payment QR code. Small vendors say the system cuts expenses. Lula da Silva has dismissed U.S. claims that PIX hurts U.S. interest or locks American firms out. We cannot be penalized for creating a fast, free, and secure mechanism that facilitates transactions and stimulates the economy, Mr. Lula wrote in a recent opinion essay in the New York Times. In its speed and ease, PIX is similar to Zelle, the payment system run by a consortium of U.S. banks. But unlike other similar digital services like PayPal, PIX carries no fees for individuals and small businesses. It allows users to make and receive instant payments using a bank account and an identifying key like a phone number or a QR code. Since February, many Brazilians can use PIX through contactless payments on their phones. Since Brazil's central bank launched PIX in 2020, it has been adopted by 175 million people and now accounts for nearly half of the country's financial transactions. It has even crept into the vernacular. What's your PIX in Brazil is akin to I'll Venmo you. But the Office of the United States Trade Representatives is investigating PIX, claiming that Brazil has given an unfair advantage to the digital payment system by requiring all banks to offer it. The U.S. trade authorities also say that by protecting consumer data that PIX collects, the Brazilian government is hurting American companies that use such information to make business decisions and develop new products. U.S. companies see this data as critical, said Ignacio Carballa, a senior consultant at Payments and Commerce Markets Intelligence, a research firm based in San Francisco. This places a lot of power in the hands of Brazil's government. PIX is also a monetary blueprint for the BRICS, B-R-I-C-S, alliance of developing economies, which includes Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, as it seeks to create an international payment platform aimed at reducing reliance on the U.S. dollar. Mr. Trump has threatened the bloc with tariffs if it tries to create a rival currency. On a busy corner in Rio de Janeiro on a recent weekday morning, the ubiquity of Brazil's digital payment system was on full display. A woman selling bright hair wraps offered small discounts to clients who paid with PIX. Nearby, a homeless man asked passersby for spare change, propping up a cardboard sign scrawled with a PIX key. Across the street, at a cluster of food stands serving breakfast, customers shouted orders as they asked vendors for their PIX. Merchants brandishing laminated QR codes as they cracked eggs onto grills and poured steaming coffee into plastic cups. Picks made everything better, much easier, said Manuel Sousa, a 63-year-old waiter buying coffee and a pastry before work. He uses Picks for most of his spending, he said, including to pay for his rent. Big or small purchase, it's all Picks. For small vendors like Luciana Gonzalez de Pantes, 44, who sold cell phone cases, cables, and gum from a tiny stand, Picks has made it easier to settle the bill with her suppliers and cheaper to receive payments from customers. It's hard enough to make a living, Mrs. Gonzalez said. At least Picks cuts out cost a little. She now accepts credit and debit cards only on larger purchases, she said, because of the higher fees those transactions carry. Brazil's finance minister, Fernando Haddad, said that Picks was actually replacing cash, not competing with U.S. companies. There's a lot of misinformation about what Picks is, he said in a recent interview. It's a sovereign digital currency. That's all it is. It's nothing more. Data from Brazil's central bank shows that Brazilians are indeed relying less on cash, with withdrawals dropping by 8% last year compared with the year before and by about a third since 2020. From 2023 to 2024, the use of Pix jumped 52%, with its number of credit card transactions rising by 11% and debit card payments climbed 2.5%. The Brazilian authorities said their system had caught on simply because it's faster, cheaper, and smoother to use than other payment methods. While PayPal is available in Brazil, Zelle and Venmo, which are tied to the U.S. banking system and offer payments only in dollars, are not. Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, Apple, and Meta, the parent company behind WhatsApp, did not reply or to requests for comment. Before Pix, financial life in Brazil was often slower, costlier, and far more cumbersome. Moving money was usually done through expensive transfers from one bank to another, or cash payment vouchers known as boletos bancarios, which could take days to clear. Pix was a necessity, said Mario Shapiro, a law professor at the Getulio Vargas Foundation, who has studied the payment method, and the private sector had no interest in developing a low-cost, accessible financial tool like it. Brazil started its homegrown system after studying digital payment methods in the United States, India, and China. The system, analysts say, has played a key role in making Brazil's financial system more inclusive because anyone with an account at either a traditional bank or a digital startup can use Pix. Many low-income people and informal workers who used to deal in cash can now use digital payments, building a track record with financial institutions. Brazil's shift to the digital payment platform did have setbacks. Soon after Pix started, criminals spotting an opportunity began abducting people and forcing them to empty their accounts through instant transfers in what became known as Pix kidnappers. Brazil's central bank quickly moved to add more safety features like limits on nighttime transfers. As its use has expanded, Pix has transformed the digital payments landscape. Ralph Germer, a co-founder of PAG Brazil, a digital payment company, said that when Pix launched, it rendered his firm's business model, which leaned heavily on cash payment vouchers, largely obsolete. He saw that the technology was superior, so we made a big bet on Pix. Using Pix, Mr. Germer's company built a service allowing cross-border payments between Brazil and neighboring countries, and has also rolled out a Pix system in the United States. Mr. Germer said he didn't see Pix as an adversary. We need innovation, he added. In my mind, there's nothing unfair about it. After the storm, turning to art, North Carolina residents come to terms with the hurricane. The article is by Eduardo Medina and photographs by Mark Bellamy. As dark clouds swirled above the mountains last September, the remains of Hurricane Helene torpedoed into western North Carolina. Suddenly, the national natural beauty that had attracted generations of artists to the region became a source for the deadliest disasters to ever strike the state. Forested hills soaked with rain turned into devastating landslides. Creeks transformed into raging rivers that uprooted homes and swept bodies miles away. More than 100 people were killed, and estimates put the cost of the damage to the region at nearly $60 billion. A year later, only about $9 billion in state and federal aid has been injected into towns that are still haunted by the devastation. To make sense of it all, some survivors have turned to volunteer service, leaned on their faith, and devoted themselves to physically restoring what was lost. A year after the storm hit, six people shared the work they created in its wake. Together, they provide a snapshot of a community still processing what happened and wrestling with how to rebuild. Desperate Rescues, Asheville, North Carolina. As floodwaters carried their house away, a mother used her last strength to lift her six-year-old girl onto the roof. She tried to remain afloat, but it would not last. Before the river swept the mother away, she told her daughter, "I love you." When the girl later recounted the story to a mutual aid organization, Beloved Asheville, the group said she told it this way, "Don't worry, now mommy's a mermaid." It was a tale that touched Edwin Salas, 51, a puppeteer in Asheville, who lost most of his work after his booth in the River Arts District neighborhood flooded. When he read it to the disaster group's Facebook page, he was moved by its mysticism. So he created a puppet show telling the story of a boy saved by a mermaid who lays the child asleep on a roof while a lullaby tinkles. Marshall, North Carolina, roaring landslides. Once the rain stopped and the scope of the storm's destruction was becoming clear, Douglas Carr Jr. waited days for his friend to text him back. Mr. Carr of Marshall, North Carolina, eventually learned what had happened. The friend's house had collapsed in a landslide. He had suffered head trauma, broken ribs, and a lung, but he was alive. "It's an awful lot of grief that you've been holding. You shook it off. It took an awful lot of drink to wash it down, but down it goes." In that moment, Mr. Carr says he is also singing to the mountains. How could they not cave from all that rain? The song is maybe a kind of bomb. It's about Colston as much as it's about awe in the face of the raw and indifferent power of nature. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 30th issue of the New York Times. Your reader's been Mary Ellen. Thank you for listening.